Welcome to Natural Recovery from Suffering. This is Scott Killaby. I have a special guest today, and I've been trying so hard to get him on here. And probably one of the first guests as on my podcast. And so today I have Mark Vicente. And I'm not going to do a big introduction for Mark. I think once you start listening to him, maybe you already know his name. He starts to tell you a little bit about what he does. I think you'll know who he is, and we're going to talk about an interesting topic today, which I'll introduce after we hear from him. Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Hey, good man. So I'm one of your first guests.
One of them, Dan's going to come on. He's co-developer, and I just began doing
Nice.
guests, and you're like, you guys are the first two.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah, so I guess, well, let me just tell everybody who I am. So Mark Vicente, I'm a filmmaker. I was born in South Africa a long, long time ago. I've had a bunch of different interests in my life. One of them was, I grew up in apartheid South Africa, saw stuff was super fucked up and wanted to change the entire world. And so I decided that filmmaking was my way to do that. I saw Star Wars when I was super young and moved to Hollywood, became a filmmaker there. And I got very frustrated in the industry after a while because I was honestly making a lot of shit. Now and again, I'd make something amazing, but a lot of it was just horrible. And eventually, I got so frustrated, I realized I need to go make something I really want to make, which culminated in this film called What the Bleep Do We Know, which is this docudrama that we made in it came out in 2004, which is about quantum mechanics, neurobiology, spirituality, and a whole bunch of things. And that's that. That's been my obsession. The other obsession, of course, was spirituality, trying to understand myself. And that led me to a whole bunch of different organizations and groups. And the most recent one that I came out of was in 2017 when I realized it was a cult. And that was the Nixium cult. And that, splashed all over the world. We had a big New York Times article, which finally got, law enforcement pay attention. We did a two-season HBO series called The Vow. It's a very, very salacious story. But because of that whole awakening from being in an organization where in essence I thought my mentor was a very advanced human being. And then I realized, 12 years later, like, no, the man is a sociopath or psychopath, and I didn't see the signs because I misinterpreted everything as sort of spiritual calm. And it was much more evil than that. And that launched me on this desire to understand these pathologies because I'd missed it so badly. I thought I have to understand how this shit works, So that's, and the last few years I've been working on this film, which will come out next year, called Empathy Not Included, where in essence I interview a whole bunch of self-confessed, narcissists, malignant, psychopaths, that kind of thing. And that has taught me a lot. So that's my basic story.
Yeah, and so you're working on some projects now and doing and quite a few things, some of which you maybe talk about and some not, but you can't talk about all of them. But I want to, just kind of where's your space now after, like, you have such a unique history, Mark. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that situates you now as, in terms of, just where's your perspective?
I mean, the thing is, as a younger guy, even as a teenager, I was so obsessed with spirituality and with God. And I realized much later, a lot of it was because I saw a lot of bad shit in my childhood. And then I was a news cameraman and I saw some really terrible things in South Africa. And I think there was a lot of pain there. And so my escape, which I didn't understand at the time, my sort of spiritual bypass was to try to imagine a more evolved way of being. Like as a kid, I thought everybody, is so hateful in this country, there has to be a better way. So my personal little mission at age like 12 was I have to change my country. I didn't understand that, I wasn't really dealing with my own pain. I was just bypassing. That understanding came later. But I became this person that wanted to fix everything, and I wanted to fix it through media. So my passion was spirituality and filmmaking. The spirituality was, there was something wrong with me, I believed. And if I just found the right mentors, I would finally find goodness because I didn't have it. It was out there somewhere. And so I looked for it in a lot of places, some okay, some good, some okay, and some fucking horrible places. And I think what happened is that the shock of realizing that the person I'd idolized as a mentor was actually, probably a psychopath, who was doing horrible things. The shock of that kind of finally jolted me out of this looking outside for the answers.
Yeah.
And finally realizing, okay, I've got shit really upside down and backwards. And what actually happened that was cool, wasn't cool at the time, but in 2017, when I realized this, you know, I was going to law enforcement to like talk to them about what this guy was doing to all the women I knew. And because he was, you know, sex trafficking and a whole bunch of rape and a whole bunch of horrible things.
Yeah.
So funny. You know, when you fall off your mind, you fall off a cliff in your mind and suddenly you can't remember what you were saying. Have you ever had that?
Yes, yes. We had that a lot.
Exactly. That's exactly what just happened. I was just about to tell you something that I thought was cool.
Yeah.
And suddenly it, I don't remember, but anyway, the point being that like, because I had everything so backwards, that's what it was. I basically rejected all spirituality. I basically said, all right, you know what? Jesus, sociopathic motherfucker, Buddha, same, like every single spiritual teacher and spiritual tradition, I decided they were all assholes.
Yeah.
And a part of me knew that it was a phase, but I was like, well, I'm fully committed to this phase. And it was my rage phase. You know, I was like 2017, 18, 19, I was in rage because we were also preparing for a massive federal trial.
Yeah.
I was working with the FBI. I was working, you know, with a whole bunch of different people and PIs and things because we're going to take this guy down. Mm-hmm. And so I was living on rage for three years. And also rage against all personal development, all psychology, and all spirituality. But what was great about it is I sort of
did that, by the way.
You know what that's like. Yeah. I kind of exercised a lot of my dependency, not all, but a lot of my dependency on that the answers were out there. And to some degree, and this is not strictly true, but I'm generalizing, to some degree, I became like a blank slate. So, you know, 2020 rolls around, the trial is over, you know, the TV show is coming out, and my wife and I just disappear to Portugal and go live near the ocean in a fishing village. And I'm just, every day I just go stare at the ocean, and somewhere in there, I start to find what I think is myself again. And so I recognized, you know, that rage for me was really necessary. I had to abandon a lot of things. And then not try to reconstruct stuff, but really like where I'm at right now and my whole podcast, you know, which is called, you know, What the Fuck Is On My Mind, is literally my curiosity about stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I don't talk about shit I learned. I talk about like what I'm thinking about or what I'm feeling. And I'm sort of reapproaching, I guess, a lot of things in a new way, because before I thought I knew everything and I was really fucking wrong. And now I'm like, well, I don't know shit really, probably. So like, let me just explore stuff and try to understand the best I can, like what's going on with me. And also then, you know, the obsession recently has been with these malignant, you know, pathologies.
Yeah. Pathologies, you know? Right. Cause you've just, can you say any more about that? The malignant pathologies, anything you've learned from that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the one project you and I have spoken about, I can't talk about. But the one I can talk about is this empathy not included, because, so it's interesting, like, my cult leader, Keith Raniere, like, you know, he sat in court for 6 weeks and denied everything and never showed any emotion, unless you knew what you're looking for. The day he was sentenced, I saw emotion. I saw him turn red.
Yeah.
And part of it was shock. I think he was absolutely shocked. Like reality crashed with his fantasy. But because there was no kind of closure of him admitting any, you know, everything. But what happened that was interesting is as I began this project, which was, you know, we began shooting like 3 years ago, I was interviewing, you know, self-confessed narcissists, self-confessed psychopaths, you know, self-confessed sociopaths. And they were very honest about the way they operate, the stuff they do to people, how they enjoy doing it to people.
Yeah.
And it was a weirdly cathartic experience for me, because then I got to actually understand what I'd been dealing with all this time. The difference was that my cult leader either was really smart in his mask, or he didn't realize that this was actually what was going on inside of him, but these people did. Mm-hmm. And there was something so interesting about there's one in particular. I'm not going to mention his name, but he's a true psychopath. Like, there's zero anxiety, true psychopathy. There is a level of honesty, even though these people lie for a living, there is a level of honesty about what this guy says in the interview.
Oh yeah.
That's weirdly refreshing.
Yeah.
Because there's no bullshit at all. Right. Like, we determined
that. Yeah, you got duped by Keith. Yeah. So he finally heard somebody. We got stories about that here. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, even when I my, the, when I started my interview with this guy, which is not in the film, but I said to him, like, can I just ask you why you're doing this? He says, to exposure. He says, I figure you're going to give me a lot of exposure. So that's true.
Yeah.
And that's the arrangement. You know, he'll tell me everything and I'm going to give him a platform, which is weird, because a part of me was like, do I want to give these people a platform? But then here's the reason I decided that I was going to go ahead and, put these people in this film. There is a Pollyanna denial in the world that most people have, where they don't want to believe that the full spectrum of human experience actually exists.
Right.
You know, they kind of want to stick to like all the happy stuff. And I'm
within them, I would even say, like, there's a lot of stuff that's within them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the thing. You know, when you talk to these people, I would sit there and go, like, have I ever felt like that? Not exactly, but I felt one thing that was pretty close. You know, like I could feel that. I would feel an impulse. Like, I wouldn't act on the things, but I would feel the impulses. They would talk about the impulse and doing the action.
Totally.
But what I wanted to do, and I think I've successfully done it with this film, and I'm very excited for people to see it, is when people see the film, it breaks through the wall of denial of the shit doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does exist. And there's a really interesting moment at the end of this film, which I think is going to stay in the cut. One of my characters says at the very end of the film, he says, you know, it's not the narcissist and the psychopaths that are a problem. It's us who follow them and who worship them. And I was like, oh my God, that's such a good line. Exactly. That's such a good line.
That's right. That's right. Also the documentary, right? That's the next
one. Yeah. That's exactly right. Because there's the way that we, everybody wants to hate these people. Okay, fine. But there's a way that we prop them up because we kind of idolize them. You know, there's a very unhealthy relationship that's going on between most quote unquote normal people and these very, very toxic people. And the toxic people continue to thrive, right?
Totally, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So we're not even getting to the other side of it. That you paint such a good picture of the what I call the overt side of things, so the stuff that Keith was doing is like, it's like whatever you can find and put in an evidence locker, but I mean, you have to, or witness testimony, but like some of the stuff we'll talk about is much more covert, but when you studied or you interviewed the more malignant kinds, I think that somehow maybe that being blown open helps to see the mirror in some way. And you know what I mean? It's like when somebody's that open, because if Keith duped you, you didn't understand his motives. You have to go almost like a mad search to understand him.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So and exactly. And the thing that I learned that's kind of blowing me away, and I think I've sort of said this much in the film. I know I keep talking about a film that nobody's seen yet, but you will next year. Everybody will see it next year. Is that, the sort of grandiose narcissism, the blowhard narcissism is very, very easy to spot. And I have people saying, oh, you're going to talk about this politician. You're going to talk about that politician. I'm going to say, well, that's easy.
Yeah.
It's easy to spot those people. It's the covert narcissism that is much more dangerous. And the covert narcissism hides itself. It wraps itself in victimization. It wraps itself in goodness. It wraps itself in charity. It wraps itself in empathy. And people who don't understand the sort of, wolf in sheep's clothing thing find it hard to see. And I think part of it is, this is what I'm understanding, this really correlates to your work. If you're in denial about that shit inside yourself, you cannot see it out in the world. You can't see it in somebody who is a covert narcissist, because you're so busy keeping at bay your own demons. You don't want to recognize the possibility that that person that the world says is good has those demons as well, and maybe doing horrible things. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally, totally. And in terms of what horrible things is, we can talk about that, what the damage is, because it might be a little bit different or show up differently, but not to get to that first, but just to look at spotting like both sides of these things, I mean, in all of us. And I'll just tell you, what came up for me is, I remember reading about the covert narcissist, and the example was given that, okay, so it's a guy who has, like, publicly he does charity work, or he's helping the kids or whatever, but then privately, he's really mean to his wife. And I'm thinking, that's still pretty overt. There's going to be evidence.
Yeah.
It could be that, but like, this is something that's really hidden. This is like, some of it is really hidden. I mean, if you can see overt behavior like that, fine. But what I found in myself is, what it was, is I have to be good was coming from buried anger. And that's what a lot of people don't realize, is that it's not that we're all going to become actual narcissists, is we have to get in touch with the emotions that make us follow these people, bond with them, or then be repulsed by them and suffer because of them. Because, you know, I think it's mostly pointing to emotional repression, because we're not going to end up with a diagnosis, most of us, but we're all going to have repression until we deal with it. And so that's what I try to talk about, is like, can I have an overt narcissism in me? And that's what I had to look at now that you're on that.
Yes. Side. Yeah. You know, so something that's been interesting is I lived a lot of my life trying to be good. And I recognized later, like, how stressful it was very stressful. It felt psychotic now that I look back at it. You know, going through pre-trial against, you know, my cult leader, the rage was interesting because I embraced it.
Yeah.
And I remember at one point, one of my sort of co-whistleblowers called me up and said, I'm getting a baseball bat. I'm going to go kill him. And I said, no, 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 no. I totally get you want to do it. I totally know how you feel. We don't need you in prison. Stand down. You know, right. And I had to sort of talk him off the ledge. But then I was thinking to myself, actually, I've had that same fantasy. It just wasn't a baseball bat. It was a sword.
Right. Yeah.
And there was something about embracing that I felt that way and not pretending that I didn't. Because I spent a lot of time pretending that I didn't have, you know, feelings like that. And I realized later, I think where a lot of my anxiety came from is trying to keep parts of me all separate until I finally recognized, like, no, there is in me.
Yeah.
I mean, I can be a wimp and I can be a warrior. There's a whole range in me. I can be, you know, I can ideate about extreme violence against, you know, somebody who's hurting my friends or hurting me. It doesn't mean I do it. But like the fact that I allowed myself to ideate about it, I don't know. It's kind of healthy. I don't think it's bad.
No, it's not. And then what we're seeing is, like, you know, I don't know what it's like for you to leave that. But when people leave situations like that, relationship or community, they're often going to suffer and be identified with the emotions that they bury. So if somebody's raging over some cult leader but can't own that and can't ever access that, that can even create, we're seeing, identification, hurt, and like victim consciousness. So that's what happened to me when I was a kid. I was bullied. I had people around me who, you know, victimized me, but I buried the rage and then was the good boy and then the peaceful teacher. And I couldn't find, and I didn't think I had the rage, you know? And it's like, when I look at other people, when I see other teachers and helpers, I'm like, no, I don't buy it. Because look, we have to get into damage, because some of this stuff doesn't go into the evidence locker, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Like, you can go beat your wife and be nice in public. That's still evidence. What I'm saying is, like, there's a lot of suffering is coming from people who haven't yet opened to the fact that it's buried anger, a lot of it, for people. And I don't know if you're an anger repressor, but the thing that I heard is, I mean, you were hurt by him and you have a right to be angry and hurt. That would be the point of healing, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Am I an angry? Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I've been legendary out of my life. I think it's less now. I'll tell you something interesting. I wanted to tell you this because, you know, I listened to your stuff and I wanted to tell you something. I have a few friends, just a very few, who would never listen to this podcast. So it's okay. Who sort of operate at this very high pitch. It's almost like hysterical happiness. And I find it exhausting. Like, I never want to suppress it in them because I understand, but I find it exhausting because it feels like I'm only experiencing 10% of them and there's 90% of them underneath that they have completely rejected.
Right.
And I feel the discomfort and the tension of what they're not expressing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, in them. You can feel it in
them. And it's not like I want to stop them. It's not like I want to say to them, hey, you know, why don't you get real? Because I care for them and I love them. And that's just the way it is. But I've noticed that I think I used to maybe like it before. And now I just go like, it's not like I hate it. It's just like, it's difficult to be around because it's exhausting. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I wonder if I feel the same way. And I think that it's safe, you know, like when I had my anger repression, if I could be around people like that, they were just safer, is how I would say it to my nervous system. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. No, exactly. And then the other thing I think you and I spoke about this the other day that I'm finding very interesting. I know I'm going everywhere, but I'm just, you know, I'm excited we get to talk. And so yeah. Here we are. The thing that I'm noticing a lot, so, you know, I look at malignant personalities a lot, and I look at personalities that, you know, most people go, yeah, they're terrible, toxic people.
Yeah.
But what I'm seeing a lot of now, especially in my tribe, you know, my tribe being, you know, the progressive, open-minded tribe, supposedly.
Yeah.
Is I'm seeing a lot of hatred masquerading as love and compassion and empathy. I mean, I see people, you know, something terrible happens in the world where a bunch of people get wiped out or somebody gets killed. And these people that are all the love and light brigade are suddenly like so excited. And I'm like, wait a minute, why are you so thrilled about something so horrible? Like, what is going on with you? And I realize, well, what's going on with you is you haven't got down to the root of your shit.
Right.
And you're in this cocoon with, you know, your fellow brethren, thinking that you're empathic. And by the way, that's the thing about covert narcissism, which I know you know. It hides behind these masks of empathy and these masks of compassion. And, you know, you'll sometimes hear somebody speaking in a very soft tone, very lovingly, you know, and they're trying to excuse a bunch of different behaviors. And when I'm with a person like that, I always think to myself, I wonder what it's going to take for the real them to come out. Like, what's the thing that's going to let them come out? And then you're going to see what would be considered rage room behavior. You know what I'm saying?
Right. I mean, but that seems like it never comes out. I mean, it took me almost to become suicidal. That's what came up for me.
That's right. You were in pain. You were in physical pain.
That's what it was for me. That's why I'm putting the work out in the world, so it doesn't necessarily have to, you know, get to those places. But you just brought something up that I wanted to come back to. And I think I've had one of those moments when we do this work, when anybody's doing repression inquiry, we have these fog out or check out moments. Yeah. It wasn't one of those, but it was very much for that. But okay, let's see. Going back to the, here's what it is.
Yeah.
It's when you said taking up a cause, when I was really deep in anger repression, I was very much into causes. I was also very, very liberal, and I'm not anti-liberal now, but I was very liberal, and I took up causes. And I don't think that a lot of people understand that taking up the cause is coming from, like, victim consciousness that's pretty unconscious, coming from childhood
stuff
a lot. And then so many victims, you mentioned that, if they only knew, like, really, because we're seeing this in KI, and I'm sure you apparently you're seeing it in your own way. It's amazing because you're not really doing this work, but you see the things that we see. Mm. Like, we get to a certain place in our work, and the victim consciousness wants to hold on so tightly for people who repress, well, especially anger, but really anything. But once they get to the repression, they finally let go, and then they don't have their causes in the same way. You know, not in the same way. Right?
Yeah.
Different.
Yeah. So something interesting that came up about 2 weeks ago, and I've sort of known this intellectually, but you know the difference, you know, when you know something intellectually and then you kind of grok it. I was thinking about this constant impulse I have. Like, I see something happen in the world and I want to make it better. I want to improve it. I want to show people the you know, what I consider the better way or whatever. And I sat there 2 weeks ago and I thought to myself, look, clearly I have a mission in my life right now at the moment. But let's just examine that. And I began to look at this constant impulse to want to improve things, sometimes to the detriment of myself.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute. And so I started to track it back emotionally. And I was realizing, oh, this is just a big fucking trauma response.
Yeah.
Like, okay, there might be things that are not part of a trauma response, although I'm not sure. I mean, I feel like we're designed in some ways by all that shit that happens.
Yeah.
But what I realize is what I want to do is not feel this automatic impulse that I have to, because that's driven, I believe, by trauma, as opposed to, like, I'd like to see if I can make that better, where it's not coming from, like, if I don't do this, I'm going to die.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I know. Right. Because you mean, like, just that inner desperation that people feel in terms of, is that what you mean?
Yeah. Like, I desperately have to do this thing.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, I'm really, like, because let's take my film right now. I'm really enjoying this experience. It's been very hard. It's been long. You know, we've had some of these people come after us. It's been kind of unpleasant. But I feel very, you know, purposeful about it. I don't feel desperate. But I noticed that when I was watching something on the news and I was thinking, oh, that needs to be fixed. And I was thinking to myself, why do I have to fix it? And that's what led me to think, like, wait a minute, what's this automatic knee jerk? I have to fix it. And who the fuck am I anyway, right, to think that I can fix it? But that's what led me to go, oh, there's some shit going on. There's just some trauma that I haven't dealt with that makes me feel like I have to, as though, what am I, the savior? You know?
Yeah. I mean, I had kind of that, I would call my ego I'm like the peaceful retreat, because I'm over here all my whole life with shadows around authority, bullies, aggressive people, angry people, big energy, people who talk a lot, people who know it all, people who are too confident. But I couldn't make a fuss about any of it. And I was trying to even make peace with them or make peace with my own shadows towards them. And I couldn't get under it because of all of that. And so that's what I want to talk about, is like, you know, when you look at the landscape of like, everybody's talking about stuff on social media. It wouldn't be awesome if it could really, if people could actually see that that's really what we're doing in a way. It's like, in terms of owning our shit, I mean, there's no way that I care until I stop picking on the bully that was in me. It was the very
You know, it's funny you say that, because like I did a post, I don't know, it was prior to the election, I think, the US election. And it was something about, you know, people needing to explore their shadows.
Yeah.
And my delivery of that particular written meme, it wasn't the best. It was a little inflammatory, and I could have chosen a better way. But what's interesting is how many people came after me. Like, it's almost like I got near the sacred protected shadow, and they came after me with like fucking vitriol and hatred. And I was like, well, that's so interesting. Like, we literally protect this repressed, suppressed shadow part of ourself with rage and with violence. Like, if you get near it, something terrible will happen. I mean, I don't feel like I've quite understood what it is yet.
Yeah.
But I noticed how I inflamed a lot of people. And again, wasn't my finest moment at all. I'm not going to tell you that I was like, it was a very smart meme. It was kind of, it was a bit snarky, you know? But it was interesting.
Yeah, I pushed some buttons. So I was going to say, what kind of emails did you get? Because did you get like the, with anger repression, if it's a victim consciousness, you might get the long email that goes in over explaining, or you're rarely, I don't know what you got.
No, I got the, you know, I'm so disappointed in you, you know, like, and I was talking about at that time, that month, and I talk about it a lot, is these tribes and the way we otherize people. Like, we have a series of checklists in our tribe, much like a cult, that you have to agree to all the boxes. You have to tick every box. And if you don't tick one of the boxes, then the tribe's coming after you. And then if somebody doesn't tick one of the boxes, they must be on the other side. Like, everything's binary.
Oh, yeah.
So I keep talking about otherizing. And so what I found is that people that had been listening to me before, because they liked my curiosity, suddenly I hit a tripwire, you know, some tripwire that made them decide that I was now evil. And I was even posting funny things about, if somebody doesn't agree with you, you know, your evil is not the only option.
Yeah.
Because I was seeing it in real time. But a lot of it was them being disappointed and like saying, oh, I knew you were a Nazi. I knew you were this. I knew you were that. And I'm like, oh, please, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
And I ended up putting it down, not because I was upset at the response, but because I thought the comment section of it was turning into Fight Club on my social media account. So I took it down, and then a couple of days later, I thought, you know what, fuck it. I'm going to leave it up, because I want people to see how it all works. You know, the rage. And what was interesting, and this is something, I know you know this. You know when you find somebody who's just raging about something, and then you go look at their bio, and their bio is all about compassion and empathy and this and a better world. And I'm like, okay, you know what? Some shit is not adding up here. And that's what made me think again about your work, because those people are hiding all their shit behind that mask. What they need to do is get in there, but they likely won't, right?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of shame and guilt around triggers, you know, for people who have like a victim consciousness and anger repression. So if they're upset with you, like, you pushed a button that doesn't fit within the paradigm of why they love you, you know, like, why people love people. And so then, like, now they're legitimately angry. There's the repression, if it is anger repression, but they can't express it. And so, you know, it might come out as this or that that doesn't look like how they show people, because that's how we are as anger repressors. And I don't know who they are, and I can't guess, you know, but I'm just saying it sounds like trauma. It sounds like the same thing, but yeah, we always.
Yeah. It's sort of like, it, you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of in hardcore religions, you know, where the people can never admit their rage. So they use the texts, they use the book, they use the rules to punish the person.
Yeah.
Because they can't admit what I really want to do is hurt you.
Yeah.
So they have to, it has to be cloaked in the theology of the religion of why this thing has to happen, right?
Yeah. I mean, when I say, I say, cause I had that conditioning. I'm like, I found in this work that I can't hurt other people. That was the empathy, or, you know, the layer of it, but under it was the anger and the fear of hurting other people, but was also anger from childhood. So I want to hurt other people. I had to own all of that. And without those shadows owned, I mean, I would get triggered just like them. I could have attacked you 10 years ago, you know, my sort of cancel culture-ish, like PC, thick green, like Ken Wilber talks about, where I can't own my stuff and I'm just looking for enemies, you know, basically.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's such a good point you bring. Yeah. Because you've got that stuff, not you, but I mean, we have that stuff going, and then we look for a target, for an outlet for that stuff.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, shadow. That's what I'm saying. Like authority. Cause like you're an authority. If I'm following you and I'm an anger repressor who was hurt when I was a kid, and I can't open to anger. So you're an authority figure, even though you're just Mark, you know, you look like that and you said something, and that's going to hit. It's almost kind of like you're a dad too, at the unconscious. That's what I learned about myself, even though I have a very small following. They'll still do that. People do that. So and that sounds like you got a dose of that, but that opens up your audience too. I was going to tell you that could change things. We talked about that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I lost a bunch of people and I gained a lot of new people. That, you know, just to go back to something you said, because I've been talking to my wife about this. Like, I'm sometimes mystified at how people like really like me or just fucking hate me. There's no like, he's all right. It's like this weird extreme. And she was saying to me, you know, she says, I think it's two things. I think that somehow the authority thing, they sort of pin their hopes and dreams on you. And then if you disappoint them, like you become the devil, which is funny because that is part of the narcissistic response. I mean, what I'm learning more and more with the people I've been interviewing in this film, you know, people think that a narcissist targets somebody to destroy them. And I'm it's not entirely true. What I think happens is they sort of, the narcissist idealizes the target because it's not a target yet. They idealize the target and they make the target fall in love with them. The target idealizes them. And there's this co-idealization that goes on. And they form this complete fantasy bond, which isn't real. And then what happens is at some point the real person disappoints the narcissist because the real person is a real person. Then the narcissist feels betrayed and hurt and now has to attack them because they are a reality and they didn't want reality. They wanted a fantasy. And so what I'm beginning to suspect is that a lot of the rage that I'm seeing online, where people like, I see that with, I have, you know, friends who are celebrities, and sometimes I'll call them and say like, oh, what the fuck is going on? Like, I said this thing and like, it's a gangbang. Yeah. And they say, yeah, because they're not, it's not you. It has nothing to do with you. They literally have a fantasy version of you in their mind, or you connect to some fantasy in their mind. It's all fucking shadowboxing. It's not you. When they love you, it's not you. When they hate you, it's not you. And I was like, oh, right. That makes more sense.
Yeah. You know?
Sometimes I have to talk to my celebrity friends because I'm like, I don't know what the fuck's going on. And they go, well, we know what's going on. This is what's going on. You know,
You do learn a lot by talking to people like that who are that open. I'm sure that that's almost like its own lesson, which made me, what came up for me was, it's also a lot like regular relationships, because we project a lot onto people, and then, you know, what we think they want to be or the fantasy.
Yeah.
And then there's the, and then, but a lot of that is just trauma. So in repression, so when I look at the malignant narcissist, I think, well, some other things happened there, you know, like it wasn't just buried emotion, but I think we can learn from them because he's so open, or those folks are so open. Yeah.
You're right. I mean, one of the things, we spoke about this other day or earlier, I can't remember. Like, it's pretty consistent now in not in the psychopath I interviewed, because he's I think he was born that way, but in some of the other people, they talk about they don't say it in these words necessarily, but they talk about a certain decision they make. Like there was a lot of pain, a lot of terrible things in their childhood. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not, I don't know. But they talk about a certain decision, and the decision was to basically kill something inside them, themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like almost imagine like the child in you, they just killed it. And they don't have access to it anymore. And I don't think in some of them, in one of them specifically, I don't think they're repressing it. I think it's calcified. I think it's almost non-existent because they keep describing this vast emptiness inside of them that they don't have access to what they see other people have access to.
Exactly.
So I would say it's dead, parent, right?
Think about a parent who tells a child every day how wonderful and greater or better, or there's no negativity. Like at some point it's calcified because it's not in the reality at all.
Yes, totally. Totally. And so what I've been learning is, okay, so they've compartmentalized a whole part of themselves that they don't have access to, which is why, you know, they talk about narcissistic amnesia, and people don't believe it, but I think it's a real thing, is they literally can't remember stuff because it's almost like the real them or the core of them wasn't online in that moment. So they're having trouble remembering an event. But what has been so mind-blowing to me is I began to look at that and realize, well, that's not that different from regular people who compartmentalize a bunch of things, don't really have as much access to it than they used to have, which is why I now understand why somebody can repress their anger, their rage, their true feelings about whatever so far away that they're absolutely mystified that they exist, you know? Like they have no idea that could be inside of them. And it's not because they're stupid. It's whatever the reason is, but it's because they've compartmentalized. There was a decision they made at some point. Now, the narcissist, I'm the real malignant narcissist that I'm interviewing, they give me examples of like what decisions they made as children, and they started doing very, very evil things. But then I kept on thinking, again, like I said, it's not that different to like just so-called quote-unquote normal people. We all do that, right? We all compartmentalize all the uncomfortable shit. And I remember like when I was in boarding school, I may have been like 8 or 9. And I was in a very strict boarding school, British boarding school, very strict, suit and tie every day. You know, you called everybody sir, you were called master. I mean, it's very, very strict. And one day I loved playing soccer and I went outside and I was enraged and I just began kicking this ball against this wall, like, and it was muddy. And the entire white wall of 3 classrooms were full of these brown spots. Mm-hmm. And I was in this fury. And I didn't really know why. And then, of course, I was punished for weeks after that. Much later in my life, I realized that what had happened is my parents told me they were leaving the country and I wouldn't see them for a number of years.
Yeah.
And I wasn't aware of my rage. I just suddenly I was kicking this ball like a maniac. And I was thinking, well, that's what happens to adults. Because we're kind of the same. We don't seem to have the awareness unless you go and do the work. You don't seem to have the awareness of like that shit's buried. And then when it comes out in these inopportune moments, what I've also now realized is now we also may have shame about the behavior that we just did.
Oh, yeah.
Which makes it worse, right?
Yeah. It's like you're telling my life story and probably people who are listening, actually. It's like when I grew up, it wasn't safe to be a malignant narcissist or to even get angry at people. But it was like safe to have chronic pain. And when you said calcified, that's what we're doing in our bodies, is like we're freezing around these emotions. And over time, it calcifies. So that's why I say that, and I brought this to you the other day, is what would be nice if we talk about narcissism is the true test is, are you open to look into those issues within yourself? Because if you're not, then it's probably calcified so much that you project outward so strongly that there is no help for that in this lifetime, perhaps. And so I say, shouldn't that be like the first test? Because if you can't get through that, well, okay. That says a lot, actually. You know, for everybody who might have that in them, like, are you open to look at it? Because otherwise, you know, I think that when you say calcification, with that chronic pain came all the shadows around authority. You see, and so that's how I felt that. And I thought, well, how would I have ever found my covert anger repression without dealing with the relational stuff, you know, and all this.
That's so interesting you say that. You kind of just, a light bulb just went off for me. I had chronic illness as a kid. And I'm just now wondering, as you're saying that, I'm wondering if that was my expression of a lot of the feelings that I couldn't express. It just suddenly got me thinking about that because I was sick a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that was it.
We see it all the time. I developed a urinary issue by faking a urinary issue to stay home from the bullies. And then age 20, I have a urinary issue, you know? Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. I wanted to just go to something else that, because you and I talked about this before. So I'm now in this world of, calling out malignant narcissism. And in my film, look at the kinds of personalities I'm dealing with, in films, they're pretty extreme. They're extreme personalities. It's not your sort of mid-range narcissist, but I'm seeing something that is so interesting to me, which is this sort of psychological splitting that goes on with narcissists, which is something is all good or all bad. But what I'm seeing in people that are sort of the anti-narcissism people, that the extreme people that consider themselves to be the empaths that are good and the narcissists are bad, is I'm seeing the same behaviors, the same kind of psychological splitting going on, where they are all good and these people are all bad. Now, having said that, I do recognize that when somebody's hurt, my belief is if they need to rage and be angry and call the other person names, go for it.
Yeah,
Like
of course.
my belief is fucking process it, go for it, be as angry as you want. I never want to say to people, well, how did you cause this shit? Because if you don't understand that people that the people exist that lie and actually get pleasure out of hurting people, it's very hard to see what you're really dealing with. I get all of that, and I never want people to feel blamed for that. But I do think it's also good for people that have been hurt at a certain point to really look at this sort of splitting thing, where we make ourselves all good, like our shit doesn't stink, and all of their shit and all of their entire life is horrible and they're evil. And some of these people, there's a level of evil in some of the people in my films that is breathtaking. Like it's like it takes your breath away. It's like, my God. Like there's one person that is that their brain is wired in such a way that their greatest excitement and joy is another person's destruction. Like it's like a different species. That's not what I'm talking about. That exists, but I do think that a lot of people are becoming so identified with the things that happen to them and their victimization that their entire identity is sort of coalesces around this, like, terrible things happen to me, and that's my only identity, and I don't want to do anything to feel better, to overcome it. I want to fester with my hatred and call the whole world horrible. You know exactly what I'm saying, I think.
I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, that's something that I'm looking at, because as I call these things out, I'm also recognizing, that it gives cover to people that don't want to find their own, I guess I'm going to say wholeness, I guess the best word I have.
I was going to add something to that because I was letting you finish that because,
Oh, that was all I had.
yeah, well. Because it's like I belong to the camp that had to be good and that did a lot of shadowing towards all the bad people. So I saw that came directly from my anger repression. So everything you're saying, we actually correlate here in conditioning in the body, where often anger repressors have to be good. I mean, we have to grow up kind of the opposite of whoever hurt us is one way of saying it. You know, whether it's big energy or angry, and so we have to tuck that down. And so I thought that's a good way to talk about good versus bad because that's what shows up at the surface. But you know, and with chaos, talk about what's driving it underneath.
Yes. Yeah. And it's funny you say that because, like, my boarding school experience, because I started boarding school when I was very young, I think I was 6 years old. Everything was about being good as well. I had the same kind of pattern you're talking about. Like everything was about being a good boy, good student, a good head server in church. Because, and it was also the thing of like, if I could just be good enough, then my parents wouldn't just leave me here. They wouldn't just disappear and, go to other countries and, they would be around. So everything was, how can I be the goodest person possible to deserve love? And a lot of my early my teens and my early 20s, I was making like anti-apartheid films about the evils of apartheid and the evils of this and the evils of that, and exposing all these things, because if I could do that enough, I would be worthy,
Yeah. I
So
took
a
on the
lot
big
of
corporations. I mean, as an attorney, I always took on the big. Yeah, same thing.
And so a lot of what I've been doing ever since, getting out of the cult is reapproaching the belief that there was something fundamentally wrong with me and questioning, like, really, what is it exactly? Why do I think that? And coming to like, I am, and again, this is not, I would by no means say, oh, I've arrived, but now there's much more of a like, I am, this is who I am. This is what I think. This is what I believe. This is what I feel. It's okay that I feel these things. It's okay that I believe these things. I could be wrong about my beliefs, In fact, now I'm very excited when I realize, like, oh shit, that wasn't right. This makes more sense. But taking the pressure off of me to need to be so good has been remarkable. Like, remarkable, because now I can just be me and figure out after years and years and years and years of brainwashing in my life in various ways, like, well, who am I exactly? I have no idea. But I'm interested in the things that interest me, because I'm like, oh, that really moves me, or that excites me, or like I watch this thing and I cry. I'm always interested in, like, when I watch stuff, what makes me cry? Like, the kind of cry that's about the beauty of something.
The beauty of something, yeah,
I'm
exactly.
so interested in that because it feels so pure to me. And I'm so curious, like, okay, so I'm that person that sees this thing and it explodes my heart. And the next thing, I'm just crying about the beauty of it. And it's so painful. It's so beautiful, it's painful. I'm fascinated at that. I have no idea what that is. I'm just fascinated at that.
Well, I'm glad you can feel it because some people can't, those kinds of emotions.
And I think this relates to your work. I think the reason I can feel it now more keenly is because I've gone into darkness pretty deeply. Like, I've seen some dark shit, and I have not turned away, and I've looked at it and tried my best to understand why somebody would do that, and try sometimes to put myself in the position of, like, well, what would I have to feel and believe to feel that that was good and okay? And so embracing some of the darkness has been interesting, because I feel like it's given me an ability to experience beauty in a way that I never have before. And it seemed counterintuitive, and I think that because I thought, well, just look at beautiful things and stay away from darkness is good. And I realized, no, it's not. It's not good at all.
Not when you have the darkness in you, not when you, sorry.
Yes, exactly.
Mark, let me ask this. I keep the podcast usually about an hour, but will you come back? It's my first question. Hope you will. Because what I think is you're about, I know you can't tell us much about your, I'm actually getting excited just talking to you a few times even before. So what can you tell us about the projects? And then also I have another question. After these projects are coming out, where are you going with all these new insights?
So the one project I can't really talk about, it's a cult project. You and I have spoken about it, but I don't want to talk about it publicly. Empathy Not Included, that'll come out, next year. And what's cool about it, I interview all these self-confessed narcissists. I interview people that have been hurt by people that have, experienced narcissistic abuse. The film is interesting because it feels like it's going to be an educational movie, and the next thing it becomes like a Jason Bourne thriller. it's kind of surprising what happens. And then I, you know, interview neuroscientists and psychologists and psychiatrists and, you know, a whole bunch of different things. I think though, what I'm starting to feel, there are a lot of other projects that I want to do. So I don't want to be the narcissism cult guy forever. I think there's a certain value in it right now, but I find even as I'm getting to the end of this, I'm feeling like there's all these other things I want to explore. Like I am interested, and this is something I do want to, I think I may start this project maybe next year. I'm really interested as well in the, what do I call it? The shadow side of enlightenment experiences, because I'm really curious about people that have these profound awakenings that then seem to have remarkable access to, you know, all kinds of incredible, wonderful things, but haven't cleaned their shit up and it just goes south, mm-hmm. you know? And then also I'm interested in some ways debunking what I believed enlightenment was, you know, because I think my version of enlightenment was really an error. I mean, it was the whole, you know, Jesus, Buddha, you have no more suffering shit.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't think that's that at all. I have no idea what it is, but my personal journey more recently has been connecting to, getting access to parts of my experience that are quite beautiful and quite amazing. And it's more an expansion as opposed to the thinning experience that I thought that enlightenment would, the thinning experience that people were offering of enlightenment, which is basically shut out all the terrible things, you know, and climb the staircase to heaven bullshit. I'm interested in that. And then there's a lot of sort of narrative projects that I wanted to do, because like sci-fi is my big love. You know, there's a whole bunch of sci-fi stuff that I want to get made. I just have to figure out how to get them made for not, you know, gazillions of dollars. Because the film industry has changed dramatically. It's sort of crashing at the moment. So we as filmmakers have to figure out how to reinvent ourselves and figure out, you know, because the whole streaming system, I think, is going to eventually collapse. The studio system is, it's just not working. And we have to figure out how to make some of these films, you know, more cheaply. But I have my eye set on sci-fi. And the reason I have my eye set on sci-fi, I've always loved it, is because I feel like you can talk about things in sci-fi that you can't talk about in ordinary stories, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's, there's a lot of wisdom in Jedi. It totally reminds me.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, you know? And I think about all the things you could deal with in like the Star Trek world. That you can't deal with in traditional stories. And like, there's only so many, you know, I was thinking about, there's a show I've been watching on, it's on Paramount called Landman, about Texas, you know, Texas family and oil rigs and shit like that. But I was thinking to myself, you know, it's kind of like a soap opera. I'm watching another soap opera. It's just set somewhere else. Or sometimes I'll watch, you know, a soap opera in space and I'm like, okay, that's interesting. But like, what about stories where people's entire version of what they thought was real suddenly gets turned upside down? That's interesting to me.
Yes.
You know, which is the film What the Bleep that we made many years ago, that was my attempt to have the audience watch a character go through this profound transformation while all these scientists and, you know, neuroscientists and quantum physicists spoke about stuff.
Yeah.
And have the audience come out going, holy shit, what just happened? Like, that's the stuff I'm really interested in exploring, you know? But I feel right now my journey is just, let's just spend a little more time looking at the darkness, at the stuff that nobody wants to explore. And not in the way of like doing what I call cult porn. I hate cult porn, you know, which is basically people watch other people's lives get, you know, all fucked up. Yeah. Like, I get people still, I mean, The Vow has been out now for, season one's been out for 4 years. I still get people like messaging me like, oh my God, what a fucked up situation, you know?
It was really, like, yeah. Dan just told me, he told me to tell you he loved it and he thought it was great, actually. It was an awful story, but I mean, the whole thing.
Oh, it's an awful story. But the thing is, oh, and by the way, the thing that's so interesting about that story as well, and I really recommend people see it, is because what we do in The Vow, we don't have a bunch of expert talking heads talking about what's going on. You know, we take you on the journey through each of us going through shit. And the one thing we do in episode one is we try to get the audience to fall in love with the thing we fell in love with, you know? And a lot of people have said, like, after seeing episode one, they're like, oh my God, I probably would have joined, you know? We wanted them to have that experience so that they could experience what it felt like to realize, like, oh shit, that was all a lie, you know, and feel what that feels like, feel what the betrayal feels like, and then feel like what the unraveling feels like, you know?
Yeah, hopefully it would help people see something too, to help spot things earlier. And
I think so. Else,
yeah, I think that's good.
I think so, yeah. I think so, yeah. But yeah, we should definitely, you know, when the film comes out, when the MP3 Not Included comes out, we should definitely have another conversation, because yeah. I'm excited for you to see it.
I also wanted, and I'm just thinking, I don't know, how does Hollywood work now? You said it's kind of dying. It's like, I hope you don't get too busy, because I want to keep picking your brain on this, because you're kind of going in a certain direction that we are, in a way, similar or not.
Yeah, yeah.
It has that element, and I want to bring you back and hope you don't get too busy, you know.
You know what? I'm busy all the time, but honestly, I love having these conversations, because I am, it's not like I'm trying to figure a specific thing out necessarily. I'm just really, really interested in this human experience.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in the stuff I didn't see and why I didn't see it. You know, what I see now.
Me too. Yeah, I get it.
I'm just so fascinated. And by the way, the entire reason that I joined that cult was because they offered a tech that did extraordinary things. You know, you got down into the subconscious and you sorted some shit out, and it was mind blowing. That's why I ended up staying with them. You know,
yeah.
I just didn't realize that the mind blowing tech took you to some very dark places.
You also think that with the way that it was set up, where he didn't deal with his shadows, and the technology, I don't know if it was, if he was transparent about it with himself, because that's the problem with technology like that. You know, I don't know how it was, because you lived through it. I haven't seen it in a while. I watched it a few years ago, but was it like that? That, because there's also the authority shadow. I mean, he did all that, and then you guys looked up to him, and then people in the organization had trauma they brought into it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, the way he talked about it, you know, you had disintegrations. You know, in other words, you had mismatches between your version of reality and actual reality. And all of those things were causing all the trouble in your life. Yeah. So what we have to do is we have to get in there and work in the subconscious and work out all the belief systems and the programs you have that make you believe that reality is different than it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way everybody spoke about him and the way he presented himself is that he didn't have any disintegrations anymore. And so, you know, he kind of looked at that, though, that's fucking amazing. And so I would say to him, like, you don't get angry. He goes, no. And then one day I was at volleyball, and the guy behind the counter at the front desk was being an asshole. And suddenly Ranieri like raised his voice. And I was like, wait a minute, that was anger. And so afterwards we're working out in the gym, and I said, well, that looked like anger. He goes, that wasn't anger. I go, well, what was that? He says, I was raising my voice to match him.
Okay.
And I was like, I mean, there was a part of my brain that was like, really? Because that looked like anger. Later, fucking 11 years later, I was like, no, that motherfucker, that was anger. That was anger.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're still talking. I can't stop because I'm getting interested now. But well, because we talked about, and I don't know him enough, but that he's a hurt and sadness repressor, because a lot of the charismatic leaders are like vulnerability repressors. They have the big energy. And then, so like, that would be a good sign. Do you get angry? Because that's a trauma response for them.
Yeah.
When I'm listening to that, I'm thinking, oh shit. I mean, the progress of my spiritual path is when I could finally get angry, you know?
Yes.
It's like,
yes.
Yeah.
But yes. Anyway. My belief with Ranieri is that he had a bunch of experiences, spiritual experiences when he was younger, that in essence, he either dissociated more, or he found a story for his dissociation that he liked.
Yeah.
It could, you know, or both, or some, you know, range in between there. But this was a man that did not have a full range of emotions. But here's the thing that's interesting. Richard Grannon, who's somebody that I work with and who's in this film, he's the sort of narcissism expert. You know, he said that to me a couple of months ago. He said, you know, the reason he enjoys speaking to psychopaths is because they know a lot more about the human condition than most people know.
Right.
Because they study the human condition.
Unemotionally.
Unemotionally.
Yeah.
Unemotionally. So they're not swayed by this, that, and the other. They study people like AI. And so they come up with conclusions that he says he finds extremely accurate.
Yeah, probably scary too. Yeah.
Oh, scary as fuck, you know, but they really do understand people. That's why they can be so effective.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so we have to go, but definitely come back. And so when is the release of
Definitely.
that? Do you know in the next?
We don't know yet. We're going to be we're going into our final edit in January. Then we have to do, you know, mix and animation and a whole bunch of things. And then there's, you know, we have to discuss distribution and film festivals. So we don't know yet, but everybody can basically go to either my website, markvicente.com, or my Instagram, or they can go to www.empathynotincluded.com and they can get updates there.
All right. Thank you so much, Mark. See you
Thank
again.
you. Thank you, sir.
Bye.